for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Building artificial trees to capture carbon, installing billions of tiny mirrors to reflect sunlight, spraying sulfate to whiten clouds, these and other geoengineering ideas for cooling the earth pose real risks of their own. But a growing number of scientists say these types of technology should at least be studied. Joining me to talk about the intentional manipulation of the Earth's climate, Margaret Leinen of the Climate Response Fund, Eli Kintish. He's author of Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe, joining us from a studio at Duke University, Rob Jackson. He's professor of environmental science and biology. And throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. I certainly have many of my own and hope you'll join me. This is indeed part of our Environmental Outlook series, so call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Eli, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
And good morning to you, Margaret.
Good morning, Diane.
Thank you for joining us, Rob Jackson.
Morning, everyone.
Eli, if I could start with you, explain this term bio-geoengineering.
Geoengineering, Diane, is a radical idea that we could actually manipulate the planet's climate directly to avert the worst effects of global warming.
How long has the term itself been around?
It actually was brought out for the first time in a paper, I believe, in the late 70s. And at that time, the idea was to basically take carbon out of the atmosphere and put it in the deep ocean. And that was the first time the word geoengineering was used. But scientists have been thinking about global manipulation of climate really for as much as long as a century. And that's because as scientists have learned how sensitive the planet is to small changes, they've thought of ways to move these levers. In the past, it might have been to push these levers actually to improve the climate. Now most scientists are thinking about geoengineering as a way to avoid catastrophe.
Margaret Leinen, is geoengineering something you see that would be helpful to or disastrous to climate change?
Well, I think we don't know, and that's the problem. Scientists have started talking about this because they're profoundly concerned about the lack of progress on emissions reduction. And I think that one of the things that we learned at our recent conference last week between the scientists and non-scientists was that everybody shared that sense that the first thing we had to do was reduce emissions and to do it very quickly. But the concern is that if we don't proceed with that, or if there are already programmed in changes that are going to happen as a result of the CO2 that we've already put into our atmosphere, that it would be prudent to do the research to understand whether any of these radical or extreme measures that Eli talked about would even work.
Rob Jackson, is there a sense of urgency facing scientists now that, say, was not there 5 years ago?
I think there is, and it's a sense of discouragement, perhaps, at how slow progress has been to reduce emissions. I mean, first of all, we want to understand geoengineering, not to promote it. We should be promoting an energy revolution, really, renewables, increased efficiency, green technologies that to help us compete in a global economy. But what if something starts to really go wrong? For instance, a runaway thawing of permafrost that floods the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, or a rapid ice melt in Greenland. Renewables and efficiencies and the things that we should be doing now, they can't help us once carbon reaches the air. So either we develop ways to scrub carbon dioxide, or we have to consider, or perhaps consider, the much riskier strategy of blocking sunlight. So geoengineering is an insurance policy, I guess, and we need to know if it'll work.
When you talk about the idea of blocking sunlight, I sort of put my hands up to my head and say, what in the world are you talking about when you get to blocking sunlight, Eli?
So I thought I'd step back and explain some of these types of methods of geoengineering that scientists have thought of. Most of them have a kind of natural analog that scientists have thought of mimicking. That doesn't make them less frightening to consider engineers actually doing in the future, but it does offer a kind of metaphor for what we've seen in nature. For example, we know that one of the reasons the Arctic is warming so quickly is that as the white ice melts away and reveals dark water, the temperature of the water rises very quickly, and that's why the Arctic is the fastest warming place. And so people thinking about solutions to this have thought of actually floating white panels in the Arctic to reflect more rays of sun back into the sky. By the same token, scientists are learning how important the reflectivity of clouds are for the entire planet's temperature. And by that token, they've thought of different ways to actually increase the reflectivity of clouds by adding particles to them, low-lying clouds. Finally, we know that volcanic eruptions play an important role in the planet's temperature, and scientists have thought of ways to mimic the cooling effects of volcanoes. In 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines poured 10 billion tons of sulfur into the upper atmosphere, and the planet's temperature went down by a degree. And so scientists are actually thinking of the radical step of mimicking this cooling effect by man-made means.
And what is your reaction to that, Margaret?
Well, I think Eli has described a whole set of techniques that are focused on blocking sunlight. There are another group of technologies that people are talking about that would remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Some of those are radical or extreme steps that involve the terrestrial biosphere, like massive planting of trees or capture or use of waste biomass to turn it into very, very fine particles of charcoal called biochar that would then be put into the ground. And those enhance the fertility of the soil and retain water. Then there are other techniques that are focused on the ocean. And the one that most people talk about in this geoengineering category is called ocean fertilization. And there are several technologies there. Some of them involve hardware, like putting pipes into the ocean that by the way they're constructed force water up from the deep water that contains more nutrients and allows more plants to grow, and they take CO2 out of the atmosphere. Others involve spreading soluble forms of iron on the surface of the ocean. Iron is a nutrient that all plants need, but that plants in the open ocean far from shore are really they're really starving for.
They're deprived. Why has that happened?
Iron is one of the most insoluble elements in seawater. And as soon as the iron hits the seawater, it forms compounds that take it out of seawater. And so only the ocean close to shore has high concentrations of iron. In fact, it's so low, far from land, that we couldn't even measure it accurately until the 1980s. And so the iron that does come in largely comes from either dust transported from the land out to the open ocean, from melting icebergs, from sediment from around islands that is stirred up.
Rob Jackson, as our listeners hear all these various ideas and theories, none, of course, has truly been tested. But why would scientists, and how many scientists, would be willing to fool with Mother Nature?
I think, first of all, it's important to think about the two different flavors of geoengineering that you mentioned at the onset, Diane. And one approach for removing carbon dioxide is something that eventually we need to do. I mean, at some point, we have to go carbon negative. We have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And there are some good ways that we can do that. There is research underway now to do that industrially, perhaps linking a renewable source of energy, such as windmills or solar, to processes that scrub CO2 chemically.
Sure.
So that's one way. There are also opportunities biologically. People might be surprised to think about planting trees as a strategy or a tool for combating climate change. But in the last 100 or 200 years, we've put hundreds of billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from things like deforestation. So hence, there are real opportunities to restore forests, keep forests from being cut, what people call avoided deforestation, as well as preserving habitats, species, water quality.
And we'll take just a short break. We'll be right back. And we're talking in this hour about different theories about dealing with climate change. Here in the studio, Eli Kintish. He's author of Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. Also, Margaret Leinen. She's founder and CEO of the Climate Response Fund. On the line with us from Duke University is Rob Jackson. He's professor of environmental science and biology at Duke University. And as part of our Environmental Outlook series, we are looking at different theories, different ideas that scientists have come up with to address the whole issue of climate change. And I'm wondering, Eli Kintish, in your book, you ask the question of whether climate science can exist without the allure of climate control. Is that what's going on here?
I think that there is a natural tendency when scientists start to study a system and a human tendency, really, to try to control it, to try to change it. But I have to point out, this wasn't really the case in climate science even as much as 3-4 years ago. I went to a meeting in 2007 where the geoengineering folks, a very small sort of clique of scientists, were meeting with some of the finest scientists in the field, and everyone thought that meeting would end up that these folks on the outside would be shunned. But given the severity of the situation, in fact, quite the opposite happened.
People are looking at it differently now. Scientists of all stripes. We come back to the issue. As you all know, there's been a great debate in this country and elsewhere as to whether the planet is warming, cooling, whether there are any changes that are man-made whatsoever. Can we address that, Rob Jackson, right here and now, in terms of the percentage of scientists who do believe that the planet is warming and cite as evidence the melting of the ice caps and all kinds of examples around the world?
There is a strong consensus in the scientific community that climate change is real and that human activities, particularly burning fossil fuels and deforestation and such, are the primary cause of that warming. That's not to say that there aren't uncertainties, such as interactions with clouds or aerosols, and that's not to say that there aren't credible people who don't perhaps see it that way, but the vast majority of scientists across many organizations really, really feel strongly that the data are clear, and that's what I'd encourage your listeners to do, Diane, not to take my word for it, and not to take someone else's word for it, but to actually go look at those data. The Earth is warming, and it's really speeding up. It's an area of great concern.
And it's because of that speeding up that you see this growing interest in trying to at least experiment on, what, small scale to address some of these possible kinds of solutions to the problems.
Yes, Diane. I think that scientists are really thinking about working on this in a very, very deliberate and slow fashion. Certainly the same kinds of models that are used for understanding climate in the future can be used to study the impact of these various techniques. So modeling is an important first step. Then there are many aspects of these technologies that still need laboratory work for development. So a second step is also laboratory work. I think the big question is what happens then? Could the techniques be studied by small experiments in the real world, in the natural world?
Give me an example.
For example, these ideas about brightening clouds. Could you go out and do an experiment that brightened a small cloud?
One small cloud.
Right. And could you learn enough from that to help you understand?
And is that a slippery slope? Because if you've got one small cloud, and then you say, well, we've gotten a certain amount of feedback from that one cloud. What do we do now?
Exactly. And that's why people are so concerned about experiments in the natural world.
Rob, how do you see that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Another issue is that we're interested and concerned about the climate, but climate protection isn't the only lens through which people around the world might see geoengineering. A person in a developing country might ask, is this an attempt by rich countries to control the climate instead of protecting it? So I can see someone saying, first, you rich countries create this problem. Now you're going to fix it by taking control of the world's climate? I don't think so. So there are some really interesting and vexing geopolitical aspects to this that even if the science could work, there will be a lot of barriers and public acceptance issues. And no, as I said before, no one wants this. This is a tool of last resort.
Hmm. Eli.
Diane, I want to respond to something you said. You said, should we fool with Mother Nature? And I think that's going to be the visceral response that most people around the world have as they learn about this radical idea. But we have to realize we don't know how the carbon dioxide that we're putting to the atmosphere is fooling with Mother Nature right now. We're not talking about just the risk of geoengineering. There has to be a weighing of the risk of doing nothing, not thinking about these radical ideas, and the risk that these ideas themselves may pose. You've got to balance both dangers. And, you know, I like to say geoengineering is a bad idea whose time has come. The scientists who are thinking about this are coming to it with the same kind of fears that those who studied nuclear weapons in the 40s did. There really isn't a strong desire to change the climate, but they feel they have no choice but to think about doing it.
But isn't it true that some environmentalists are staunchly opposed to this kind of geoengineering? Margaret.
Certainly. There are many environmental groups that are very reasonably concerned about this and very alarmed by the idea that scientists want to do this.
And lack of guidelines.
Others have said, as Eli said, it's an idea that we don't want to think about, but we have to think about. And so now even some of the most prominent environmental organizations are starting very early discussions about what is this? Is it how do we get to know about it? What concerns should we convey to the scientific community about those guidelines?
Talk about this international conference that was held last week on climate intervention technologies. I gather it was last month in Monterey. Is that correct?
That's right. We had been concerned for some time that there were lots of venues where scientists could talk amongst themselves about the science, but there weren't any venues and there weren't any discussions emerging where the people concerned about risk management, governance, ethics, economics, international law, public opinion could come together with the scientists to talk about that. And so we sponsored a conference, a week-long conference, that was modeled on a very famous early conference in the 70s that looked at recombinant DNA when people were very concerned that that might result in
killer bugs that would get out into us,
into the environment. And it wasn't so much that this was an exact analogy. I think the thing that they had in common was that the scientists voluntarily came together and said, we're very concerned about this research. Help us understand what kinds of guidelines are necessary and would make people, not just technical guidelines, but also guidelines about availability of data. Should these projects have international review, not just review by the country doing them? All of those very, very important questions.
And Rob Jackson, what has been the role of the U.S. government thus far?
Well, both the U.S. government, the House of Representatives, for instance, and the House of Commons in the U.K. have been holding parallel hearings this spring. I testified a few months ago at a hearing in the House. I think the Science and Technology Committee is trying to figure out what to do and in general supports at least very small-scale research in this topic. And I think the reason for that, again, isn't a sense of wanting to promote geoengineering. It's wanting to know if it will work. So the worst thing that could happen is for policymakers to count on geoengineering down the road, and then when we actually need it and try it, it doesn't work, or perhaps it causes other large-scale environmental problems.
And that's the worry, isn't it, Eli?
I mean, absolutely. You don't want to have to think something's in your back pocket and in the future be unable to use it or to rely on it. I do think that the reason that the House of Representatives Science Committee is considering this now is because the federal government really hasn't supported geoengineering research. And I think the real reason for that is connected to the idea of the way environmentalists are thinking about this. There's a real worry among policymakers that by talking about geoengineering, you actually might undermine the case for making the hard choices when it comes to reducing greenhouse emissions that people may have to make. And that's the reason that environmental groups haven't been so aggressive in supporting this idea. But you have to balance that idea. It's called moral hazard, you know, of talking about something like insurance or geoengineering or seatbelts with the possibility that if you don't do that, you might lose an opportunity in an emergency.
But what about Rob's point that it could pit rich countries against poor countries, that there would be an economic imbalance in not only the way the research develops, but the manner in which it's used?
There really hasn't been an international discussion at all about this.
And there needs to be, doesn't there?
Right. Margaret's conference is a good first step.
Yeah.
But there weren't that many international scientists there. It's not her fault, but it's just a really, this conversation is still mostly U.S. and U.K.
Eli Kintish, he's the author of Hack the Planet, which sounds like a strange title, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Explain that title.
Hacking is the idea of altering a system, hacking into a computer. There are websites now, you know, mind hacks that give you tips on how to be more efficient. And I thought that there's no sense hiding from people how radical this idea is.
And here's our first email from Jonathan here in Washington, D.C., who says, this well-intentioned idea scares the hell out of me. Scientists have yet to improve on anything nature can create. We can mimic, but copies invariably present more problems than solutions, and it seems a slippery slope. I'm not talking about green technologies. This seems something equal to the defense industry's Star Wars program of the late 80s and early 90s. Rob Jackson, how do you respond?
Well, I think that's the first reaction that all of us have to this. It's, and particularly for sunlight blocking and manipulating global climate, it feels like playing God with the Earth, and no one is comfortable with that choice. For instance, imagine needing to blast dust into the stratosphere, 100 years down the road. Imagine that happening and a large drought starting in the Sahel or in the United States or somewhere else, and not being able to know whether that drought was caused by the climate manipulation. When we block sunlight, we also change the world's water cycle and dial down the evaporation of water, for instance. So it raises all kinds of uncertainties that we really don't know how to deal with. And the issue of governance came up earlier in the call as well. What are the rules for this?
Sure.
Who sets the thermostat? How do we control this and keep safeguards in place? That's why it's such a difficult problem.
Eli, you've written that the whole climate crisis begins and ends with coal. And we've recently had a number of tragedies in coal mines, and yet coal continues to be relied upon as a source of fuel in this country and around the world. Why couldn't we just stop coal mining?
I don't have the figures at my fingertips, but coal represents the biggest single source of energy in this country, and it's the biggest single source of carbon emissions. It's the fastest growing source of carbon emissions, both in the developing world. And coal is really at the center of almost everything we do. The food we eat, the products we use come from chemicals that are often derived from coal. We simply haven't found a way as a species to change our way of life so as not to be reliant on a source of energy that's frankly very destructive and dangerous, changing not only our atmosphere, but putting our workers at risk and causing all kinds of other environmental challenges.
wouldn't an alternative to this kind of geoengineering be a Manhattan Project to search for and to develop alternative forms of energy? Margaret.
Absolutely, Diane. And you heard Rob make that comment earlier in the show. And I think that everybody is looking for that. One of the difficulties, however, is that we already have an infrastructure associated with coal for production of electricity especially, but also for other energy sources. And that transition from this old technology or old source to a new energy economy is the key. Will that happen quickly? Can we do that in the next 10 or 15 years? Or are we really looking at a long time that will put more and more CO2 into the atmosphere?
Margaret Linen, she's founder and CEO of the Climate Response Fund. When we come back, we'll open the phones, read your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Nearly a year ago, Merchant Marine Captain Richard Phillips became the first American seaman to be captured by pirates in two centuries. He tried to escape, but was caught and beaten. 5 days into the ordeal, Navy SEAL sniper shot and killed three of his captors. He has a new memoir. On the next Fresh Air, we hear Captain Phillips' story. Join us.
And it's time to open the phones first to Palm Beach, Florida. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Diane. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, sir. Go right ahead.
Okay. Just a comment and then a question. I thought that over 30,000 scientists have already come out and signed a petition that said that global warming wasn't real. And then my question is, for John P. Holdren, our science czar, came out last year and stated that there was already experimentation with geoforming the Earth with chemtrails. Here in South Florida, we see chemtrails every day and even at night. So I would like to see what your panel has to say about chemtrails. Have they noticed any effect from you know, with temperature reduction, we do see cloud increases when they do chemtrail.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Eli.
I think what the caller brings up, and we're going to see more and more of this, is a kind of populist strain of conspiracy theory that exists in the United States. The more we talk about geoengineering in the serious spheres of science, I think on the fringe you're going to have people like Jim who are concerned that the government may be acting secretly or that corporations are messing with the sky. In a year and a half of studying this problem, there's no evidence that I've seen that there is some sort of project to be doing this right now. But there is a vibrant community on the internet that believes that we are doing these chemtrails right now. And I think what it...
What are chemtrails?
Chemtrails is this theory that the government is already using planes to add particles to the sky, to change the climate, to maybe affect people's health in some nefarious way. There's no evidence that it exists. I don't think it's real. But as serious scientists like Margaret and Rob talk more and more about this radical idea of doing geoengineering on purpose in the future, I think there's going to be increasing calls by these conspiracy theorists that the government is already doing it.
Rob Jackson, do you see any evidence that the government is already involved in this kind of work?
Well, the caller's question also relates to ship trails. There is evidence that as ships move across the oceans, the pollution from their exhaust creates small pockets of clouds and can cool things or brighten those clouds, block sunlight. As to a conspiracy, I just don't think so. Let me give you an example. My older brother's an FBI agent, and he likes to say that the federal government is too, say, not competent enough and not monolithic enough to pull off any kind of large-scale conspiracy
but
such as this.
Rob, you didn't answer my question directly. Is there any evidence that the U.S. government is currently involved in any of these experiments?
Not to my knowledge, Diane, not at all.
And Margaret?
Not that I know of.
And Eli, you're saying absolutely not.
No, absolutely not. And the thing that Holdren said last year was simply that we need to keep research into geoengineering on the table. He certainly didn't admit to any sort of government spraying already.
All right. To Huntsville, Alabama. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
How you doing? A couple of comments that I would like the panel to, or a couple of, comments I'd like the panel to comment on also. First of all, with regard to the, within the last year and a half, the fraudulent documentation that came out of East Anglia University in Great Britain, where it was, their stuff was deliberately doctored, and with the coldest winter on record, do people really believe that the American public is so ridiculously stupid to buy your theories?
Jim, thanks for your call. Rob.
There was just a report released by the UK House of Commons. The caller is referring to something called ClimateGate, the hacked emails from the Climate Center in the UK. The first of several reports has just been released. It was released last week. So an independent body concluded that there was no data tampering, no perversion of the peer review process. They scolded the scientists for a couple of things. Not sharing data was the most important of those. And I think from my take on the ClimateGate emails, they show arrogance. And arrogance is unpleasant in any group of people.
Any comment, Eli?
I mean, the way science works, Diane, and Jim... Jim, I understand that there's a lot of talk on the blogs out there that might suggest there's some sort of conspiracy by scientists to keep something away. But the way that science works is that there would be such an advantage to a young scientist to blow the cover of this whole conspiracy if there was one, that there would be no way we would be able to have the IPCC publish every 7 years this definitive report. The way things are set up is that if there's a new idea that knocks down the consensus, science will reward that, and that just hasn't happened.
Margaret.
I agree with both Rob and Eli, but I also want to say that I think that scientists in our field have not really understood how much is at stake here and how careful they have to be to really move to the highest standards of scientific excellence, the highest standards of credibility, the highest standards of use of data.
All right, to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Steve.
Yes, Diane. Hi, I'm on my speakerphone. I'm just changing over.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a subject near and dear to my heart. I've been studying this issue of climate change since about 2000. And something I want to make your callers aware of is that since 1999, there's been, actually, it has to be, governmental airplanes that have been spraying barium and aluminum oxide in the air, creating chemtrails. Now, it's very easy to tell the difference between a chemtrail and a contrail. A contrail will dissipate in about 20 seconds. A chemtrail will linger in the sky, broaden out, and four or five planes can occlude a blue sky in about 4 hours. Now, what I invite your station to do is to entertain credible people on this issue of ongoing weather manipulation via aerosol spraying of aluminum oxide and barium.
Steve, I understand from what you've said that you've been watching and studying this situation for a long time. Tell me what your evidence is that the United States government has been spraying barium and aluminum oxide into the atmosphere. Have you actually studied these chemicals as they've fallen from the sky? What is your evidence?
The best way that I can help you and the listeners is to go to very credible websites, California Skywatch, New York Skywatch, my own site, Missouri Skywatch, and begin to read up on what's going on. This panel, I believe, is not paying attention.
All right, sir. Rob Jackson, maybe you're not paying close enough attention.
That was a comment to me, Diane.
I'm just making that comment to you. I'm just wondering what your reaction is.
Well, I'm not an expert on either contrails or chemtrails. I just said before that, to my knowledge, there is no evidence and no certainly
but
quantitative evidence for
this. Why is there this continuing accusation that this kind of chemical seeding of clouds is still taking place? Margaret?
I'm not sure I can answer the question of why there is still the controversy, but I will try to address some of the issues that the caller brought up. First of all, with respect to contrails that disappear quickly or those that persist, the persistence of the contrail is related to the atmospheric temperature that the plane is going through, the amount of water vapor, and the interaction between the temperature and the water vapor. It is not related to aluminum or barium in the contrail. I would also point out that for those that are skeptical of anything else, during the time after 9/11, when all of the planes were grounded and there were no contrails, there were very, very substantial studies of contrails and their effect on the atmosphere and their effect on the chemistry of the atmosphere by the scientific community. There was no evidence after 9/11 of a reduction in barium or aluminum oxides or anything else that might have been put into chemtrails. There just is no evidence that the government is putting these materials into plane exhaust.
All right, to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Doug. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. It really does. I just want to say quickly, it does shock me and give you pause that so many people are calling in with these conspiracy theories. I think it does give one pause as to how difficult getting real substantial carbon reductions accomplished is going to be. One quick comment, just very quickly. I think it's great that we would push for energy efficiency and low carbon technologies. At the same time, just a little, people don't recognize how much we've spent on those already. We've actually spent more than the Apollo and Manhattan projects put together on nuclear fusion and other related low carbon technologies. So it's just the scale of what we need to accomplish to get 80% reductions by 2050 is very significant. One thing I wanted to just question, commentators have mostly talked about albedo modification, reducing the amount of sunlight coming in, which doesn't address what's called ocean acidification. The commenters can, I would assume, can talk more about exactly what that is.
Sure.
But that is a significant concern. And how do we address that at the same time?
All right. Thanks for your call, Eli.
I mean, the caller brings up the idea that we have to, you know, pour everything we can into this Manhattan Project, the societal transformation to cut our greenhouse gas emissions. But what scientists have found is that even if we put everything on the table that was proposed at Copenhagen, even if we aggressively went after all these cuts that nations have considered, you might have a doubling of CO2, and that effect could be that could lead to radical warming in this planet. There's two reasons. First, you have momentum of the system. Even if we stopped emitting tomorrow, the ocean would continue to warm up. And the second thing that callers need to think about is that there's uncertainty as to how sensitive the system is. It could be a little sensitive, or it could be very, very sensitive. And it could be as much as 10 degrees warming that we see.
Eli Kintish, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Kevin, who says one big concern about climate engineering is that it will work, or we will plan on it working, causing people to think we no longer need to wean ourselves from a carbon-based economy, ignoring all the other damage that carbon extraction and use do to the air, water, and soil, which we depend on for our survival. We are destroying the land, poisoning our water, and killing the oceans, just to name a few problems. Margaret.
Well, I think that if this were used as an alternative to reducing emissions, Kevin's concerns would be very, very important. But again, people are talking about this really as an emergency response, as an intervention, especially the techniques that are solar radiation management. And that while that was going on, you would still have to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere by some other means, directly removing
CO2.
So
you're saying if all of our fossil-based fuel were completely eliminated, the planet would continue to warm?
That's right. We know from our studies of the last couple of years that if we stopped all fossil fuel emissions today, the planet would still warm up by about a degree over the next century.
Well, then perhaps others would argue it's just the nature of the planet, Eli.
We face a choice right now. Do we consider making the hard choices that we need to make to start to wean ourselves off this destructive and surprisingly pernicious trace gas? Or do we continue what we're doing and head to a future which might include, famines? It might include sea level rise off the charts, that we've predicted. It might include desperate geoengineering at the last minute by a single country, or fights over geoengineering. We have to think about geoengineering, even though it's something that we don't want to do.
Rob Jackson, last word for you.
I think, as I've said before, we don't want to implement geoengineering. What we need is a price on carbon so that all kinds of good things happen. We become more energy efficient. We improve our air quality. We improve our balance of trade and national security when we price carbon, pollution goes down, and many benefits increase.
It's interesting, the question of whether we as humans are actually smart enough to accomplish this. Here's a quote. Geoengineering, wrote climate change advocate Bill Becker of the Presidential Climate Action Project, is based on the outdated and repeated discredited assumption that we humans are smart enough and wise enough to rule over the rest of the biosphere. We leave it at that. I'm sure we'll be talking about this a lot more as time goes on. Margaret Leinen, Eli Kintish, Rob Jackson, thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.